Hi, I'm Sarah Gardner, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of June 28th, 2013. Get ready, people, because today
we are going to witness the most anticipated match in the history of professional wrestling.
Wrestling over personal finances, that is. Money can lead to tiffs, spats, quarrels, even the occasional fight, and sometimes we're talking pocket change.
Certainly I can cut my energy usage, but the things that he's complaining about are small potatoes compared to the electric heater that he uses every morning in the bathroom. True, but the kilowatt says that barely uses any electricity at all. It calculated out to less than a dollar per month.
That's a dollar.
Okay, then. So,
Let's get ready to rumble!
Okay, everybody, raise your hands if you've ever gotten into a big fight with somebody over money. I'm raising my hand, so is our producer, our engineer, and I bet you are too. So we're going to talk about how and why we get so worked up over money, whether it's battling with a partner over vacation spending, or your landlord over the rent, or your health insurance company over a bill. But first, we're going to start out with the landmark ruling that captured our collective attention this past week, 83-year-old Edith Windsor's fight with the United States over her right to inherit money, tax-free, following the death of her lesbian partner. Here's Windsor shortly after the decision came down on Wednesday.
The Supreme Court has announced its decision in Windsor versus the United States, and we won everything we asked and hoped for. Wow.
Wow is right, because the ruling struck down a key provision in the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA for short. It was the part that denied federal benefits to legally married same-sex partners. Now, those couples can get the same federal benefits that all other married people do. Jill Schlesinger is here with us to talk about what that means for the personal finances of gay couples. She's a CBS News business analyst and personal finance expert. Jill, welcome.
Great to be with you.
We all know that, you know, marriage comes with a host of financial benefits, and today we can't talk about all of them. So let's just talk about a few. Jill, what are the biggest impacts of the Supreme Court's decision on gay couples financially?
Well, I think the first one is that if you are married and you're a heterosexual couple, you always have had a union under the eyes of the tax law.
Yeah.
And that's something that gay couples haven't had. So I think that the income tax part of this is going to be important. I will also say that if you are a high wage earner and you're gay and you want to get married, you might actually be popping up into a new higher tax bracket. So that's something to consider.
Right.
The estate tax is a big one. I mean, the Windsor case, the whole thing that blew up DOMA was argued on estate law. When you are married as a heterosexual couple, you can pass assets back and forth, and the death of the first spouse doesn't have any estate tax implication.
Huh.
But as if you were married as a same-sex couple before DOMA was overturned, money that was over a certain threshold would be taxed. So I think estate tax is a really big one,
right,
especially in the states where we have marriage that is approved. I think there'll be 12 in the next coming months. I still think that there's some thorny issues out there, and it'll be interesting because one big one is divorce.
Right. I was just going to say, we don't want to bring that up when
yes,
we're celebrating marriage, but
There's no reason why gay couples should be any more successful at marriage than straight couples, is there? So when I was a financial advisor, I had a handful of gay clients.
Right.
And when they broke up, it was a nightmare because there was no framework that you could use.
Yeah.
So I think that in divorce, it's going to be also actually helpful for gay couples. I'm not so sure how it's going to work if you are married in a state that has approves of same-sex. If I get married in California and then I move to Utah, I'm not exactly sure what happens there. And
yeah.
I think that's we're going to need some clarity on that.
Right. It's almost an argument for staying put, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you might want to say that we're in some sort of pink ghetto. Just keep yourselves confined to the states that have approved same-sex marriage.
Now that we have this ruling, of course, as you alluded to, some of this is going to get really complicated for people. Where can people go to get legal assistance or advice to navigate this new legal territory?
You know, I think that, first of all, I think it's going to be available and much more readily available in about 6 weeks, because I think that there's going to be some things that are clarified. And if you're really stuck, you can get on the phone with someone who is a financial advisor or a planner or a CPA who has some depth of knowledge in these things. I think it's going to be hard to just do it on your own. All of my friends who are married in New York State said, well, that's the end of doing taxes on my own. I will never do taxes on my own again.
Right.
But be patient. Nothing has to get done immediately. We are going to have a few weeks here where there'll be a little bit of disarray. And just like I would tell a straight couple, I would tell a gay couple, don't just start walking down the aisle. You still have to do all the hard work, which is, you know, you have to be in love. There's that. But you also have to have conversations about what are you going to do with your money? How are you going to treat your money? Are you marrying your finances now? There's some very big issues that gay couples really didn't have to think about. So really take your time. Don't have to make any snap decisions. Go have some champagne and celebrate. Plan the wedding, but have the conversations as well.
So, Jill, I know this was a very personal issue for you and your partner. What was your reaction when the court made this historic ruling on Wednesday?
You know, I have been very involved in this issue from the beginning. I'm on the advisory board of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, basically a legal advocacy group and a civil rights organization that fought the original marriage case in California.
Wow.
So that seems like a long time ago. So that was the case they won.
Yep.
And then it was overturned by Prop 8. So, you know, I really was so elated, and I've been so involved in this issue for a long time. And I actually had tears.
Oh, I can totally imagine. Jill, it has been a pleasure. Jill Schlesinger is a personal finance expert and CBS News business analyst. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've got more information on how the Supreme Court decision affects same-sex couples and their finances. It's at marketplacemoney.org. So the month of June is coming to an end. All you folks who tied the knot or are contemplating a walk down the aisle, stop right now. Now, I'm not saying call off the wedding, but just be aware, before you get married, the number one thing that couples fight over is money. Marketplace Money and the Public Insight Network have collaborated on a digital project called Financial Feud. We asked you to tell us what your last money fight was about, and let's put it this way, our cup runneth over with responses. Now, a lot of the financial feud stories we've received are online now. They're part of a new online game we have where you can vote on who's right and who's wrong in each dispute. You can also submit your own financial feud if you're so inclined. Now, that's just what John did. He wrote to us about arguing with his partner, Jim, over energy use in their home in San Francisco. Hi, John. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hi.
Good. So let's get started.
Round one. Fight!
Okay. This isn't Mortal Kombat. We don't just want you to slug it out on the air. We're going to actually try to help you resolve this fight. So I'd like you to meet Dayana Yoakum. She's a consumer finance expert who writes for The Motley Fool, and she's here to be your personal finance mediator, you might say. Hi, Dayana.
Hi. Thanks for having me here to referee.
You're welcome. John, let's start with you since you contacted us in the first place. Why don't you just sum up what money matter you and Jim are fighting over?
It has to do with our energy bill. In the last few months, it has gone up, I know not a lot, but $15. And I was giving Jim trouble about him leaving his light on in his office or listening to music through the stereo, through the computer, instead of just streaming it directly to a Bluetooth speaker.
Right. And Jim, what about you? Is it part of this your fault?
Well, the reality is that the things that he's complaining about are small potatoes compared to the electric heater that he uses every morning in the bathroom.
In San Francisco, you have a heater.
Yeah, it's cold in the morning. I wake up at around 5 o'clock, and it's around 50 degrees outside, and it's about 60 degrees in the bathroom, and so I like to preheat the bathroom a little bit before I take my shower.
Yeah. Now, how much is this bill per month?
Electric and gas combined, it's like $50.
But I bought one of those kilowatt devices that measures energy use of appliances. And when I put the kilowatt on his heater, though, it just went through the roof because obviously a heater uses a lot more electricity than just a computer and a couple of compact fluorescent light bulbs.
Now, I hear you're using a white noise machine, though, too.
True, but the kilowatt says that barely uses any electricity at all. It calculated out to less than a dollar per month.
Okay.
That's a dollar.
So, Diana Yoakum, let's bring you in here. Any advice for these guys? It's a blame game on the energy bill.
Yeah, Jim totally means business here if he bought a kilowatt measure. My goodness.
Yeah.
So we're talking $15 a month. This isn't a make or break amount for you guys, right?
No, I have $15 of loose change in my briefcase right now. So
so then I'm thinking this may not just be about money, as things frequently aren't.
Right.
This is a different issue. This is about priorities and maybe how you were raised, how you saw your parents manage money. And that's a bigger discussion. Have you had that talk with each other?
No, but I think we were both raised almost the same way, where our parents didn't spend frivolous money on anything. I remember a piece of tape over the thermostat when I was in third grade saying, if you're cold, put on a bathrobe.
Yeah, I think a sticky note on that heater is going to be going on tonight.
I think that's a fire hazard, but
yeah.
Anyhow, details. So compromise is key, but even more so, I think this friendly competition here actually could be used for good. Sit down and come up with some big, fun goals that are going to require money to achieve. So whether it's a vacation or something for your house, make it a competition to save towards a goal that both of you are excited about instead of looking at every penny on the utility bills. Frame it in a way that it's like, you know what? I would rather spend this money in our vacation fund. I think it sort of minimizes the daily squabbles over this.
Yeah.
But barring that, John, write Jim a check for $180 and use the space heater.
You know, he doesn't complain because I preheated the bathroom when he gets up to take his shower. So that's why he's never cold in the bathroom.
Diana, I think that's pretty good advice. So we'll leave it at that. Diana Yoakum is a consumer finance expert with The Motley Fool. And John and Jim, I hope you sort this all out. Let us know what happens.
Absolutely.
Will do.
And if you're listening at home and want to weigh in on John and Jim's financial feud, you can. Just visit marketplacemoney.org/financial feud to vote on who's right and read about other money fights or tell us about your own.
You're talking about a $15 difference. I mean, let him have his heater.
He wants to be freezing early in the morning. That sucks.
Does he necessarily need the heater in the morning? Take a cold shower. He wakes you up. That's what I do.
Great first round.
Wow.
Incredible.
This weekend, we're talking financial disputes, a fight over that astronomical cell phone bill or the grocery tab. We've all been there. And hopefully we come to some amicable solution about how we've spent our hard-earned cash. But some money disputes, they end up in court, like small claims court. You know, the kind you see on that TV show People's Court. But People's Court won't prepare you for the real thing, folks. So we asked Kirk Shelton to teach us the basics. He's acting chief of counseling and dispute resolution at L.A. County's Department of Consumer Affairs. Kirk, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So talk about how small claims court works.
Sure. So small claims court is all about getting justice. It's a court for the people. It's no lawyers. It's a chance for you to go in, meet with a judge, and tell your story. You file some paperwork. You get a court date. You have a chance, not very long, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes at the most, to tell your side of the story. The other side gets to tell their side of the story. And judge is going to make a decision on who has the merits of the case.
Right. But the amount that you're disputing over, it has to be below a certain amount, right?
Right. Here in California, it has to be under $10,000.
Under $10,000. Okay. So what kind of cases are the most common?
by far the majority of what we see in there are landlord-tenant disputes, a lot of times involving security deposits or trying to collect on rent or damages to a property. But you really see the gambit.
Okay. So if our listeners hear this and they think, yeah, I've got one of these cases, I want to go to small claims court, give them an idea of how the process works. Just a lot of us think, you know, we've watched too much TV. We think we're Alicia on The Good Wife or something. We're going to go in there and dazzle the judge with our brilliance, you know, but we really have no clue. So what's some of the protocol that we should follow when we're defending ourselves?
Yeah, and that's a great question because it's all about following the procedures. It's a process. So when you're doing that first step of filling out the paperwork, you need to make sure you do it exactly right. You've got to name the party correctly, and it's got to be a party that you're going to be able to serve to give them a copy of the information. So it needs to be some, you have to have some way of a local contact that you can serve it to. So it's really important at that first step, fill out the paperwork, get all the information correctly, and then file it with the court. They're going to give you a court date here in California. It'll be within 70 days. And in court, you've got to be organized. It's a short period of time. You've got to have your evidence laid out. And I mean, as you said, it's not a TV drama. You don't want to bring in the drama. You got to bring the facts into the courtroom and really explain your case. Show your evidence. Walk the judge through why you're owed this money.
And when you say evidence, that could just mean a good record of receipts or what, checks, that kind of thing?
Exactly. It can be receipts. It can be a contract that you signed. It could be a lease agreement. Sometimes it's just pictures showing what you're trying to show. But it's not about the flair and the razzle-dazzle. It's really about getting to the facts and explaining why you're owed that money.
I'm curious, do most people come in prepared like that?
No. I think that could be the biggest thing to help you winning your case is really being organized and being prepared. We recommend that people stop by and go see a case ahead of time because it's open. It's welcome. You can go see other cases, and it really gives you an idea of what works and what's not going to work in the courtroom.
I assume also that you have to have a lot of patience if you go to small claims court. I assume there is a backlog.
Yeah, it is a process. And so there's going to be that first up to 70 days to file the case. And then even once you get your hearing, it's still the process goes. It doesn't end with winning your judgment. Even if you go in there and you win, then you're going to need to collect. And that's the next process. And that's where some people really run into some problems.
Well, let's talk about that because we've gotten a lot of mail from people who were very frustrated. We asked people on our Facebook page about their experience with small claims court. And a lot of them were complaining about it. And one of them, Liz Gross, wrote to us and said it was terrible, quote unquote. She won her judgment, but she still hasn't been paid. Jeff Gregory wrote to us that, quote, it was a waste of time and resources. So what is it about the collection process that can be so frustrating?
Yeah, and it's really important you go in with your expectations at the right level and you know what to expect going in. Once you win your judgment, it's not, you don't walk out of the courtroom and get a check right there. It's going to be, the debtor has 30 days to pay you. And if they don't, and in many cases they don't, then you have to start going into other processes to collect. And there's options available. Here in California, you can garnish the wages. If you know where they bank, you can get it straight out of their bank account. Or you can work with the sheriff, if it's a business, to go into a till tap where you actually go and take money out of the cash register to pay that judgment.
Wow.
So there are options available. Judgments are good for 10 years, which kind of gives you an idea of how long it might take. You have quite a while there to collect that money.
So we've talked a lot about California law here. Do the laws vary state to state?
Yeah, there are differences from state to state, and different jurisdictions are going to have different rules and procedures. And so it is important really to make sure that you understand kind of your local court. But many states have developed kind of similar ideas so that people have this opportunity to go to the court and resolve these kind of smaller amount cases.
So you have to have patience to go through this process. If you don't have the patience, are there other alternatives instead of going to small claims court?
Yes, definitely. One of the things that we recommend that some people do is look at a mediation process. In many areas, it's available for free. And what a mediator will do is they'll sit down with both sides and try to talk out the problem.
Huh.
In a lot of cases, there is some agreement on both sides. And if you can just get someone in there, a neutral party, who can help really identify what the needs of both sides are, you can reach an agreement without even having to go through the court process. So that's another great option for some people. Plus, there's some kind of cases that aren't appropriate for small claims.
Like what?
Small claims is a money court. You have to be able to want to get money. If you don't want to get money, going to small claims court, you're not going to be able to get what you want. And so if what you're trying to do is get family photos that your cousin has taken from you, small claims isn't going to help
Forget
you with
it.
That. Exactly.
Mediator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or all sorts of barking dogs, animal complaints, stuff. If you can't monetize the damages, small claims isn't going to be the right place for you.
I'm curious, what's the weirdest case you've ever seen in small claims?
There have been a lot of weird ones. One of my favorites was a jilted fiancé who wanted his ring back when his bride, and actually she had sold it. And so he wanted the ring back as his first thing. And we told him small claims really, you know, it's not getting stuff back. It's getting the value of it. So
right.
you could sue her for the value of the ring. And they went to court and they got it and overheard outside the courtroom It was overheard her yelling at him, and this is why we're never going to get married.
So did he get his money back?
He did, actually.
How much?
I believe it was $2,500.
Yeah, which is substantial.
Yeah.
Right. Kirk Shelton, he's acting chief of counseling and dispute resolution at the L.A. County Department of Consumer Affairs. Kirk, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been great.
Okay, get out your scorecards. It's time for you to be the judge in another round of Financial Feud.
Fight, 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 fight.
I don't see anyone fighting, do you?
They're talking about us. We're fighting.
Well, don't mind if I do.
We're helping folks today resolve their disputes over money. It's a special collaboration between Marketplace Money and the Public Insight Network, PIN, as we call it. PIN gave us people with some very relatable stories about their financial feuds, like Chen, who lives in Oakland. Hi, Chen.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for being with us today. Chen wrote to us about a tiff between him and his two housemates over their grocery bills. And we have asked personal finance expert Louis Barajas to weigh in on Chen's situation. Hi, Louis.
How are you? I'm ready to rumble as well.
I'm good. That's good. Okay, Chen, let's start with you. Tell us about the arrangement that you and your two roommates had originally agreed on when it came to groceries and meals.
My two housemates, Paul and Lizette, and I get together every 3 weeks for a house meeting, and we go over our chores as well as anything financial that we need to attend to. We share everything, including food. We shop on our own and then bring back the grocery bills and split up each grocery bill.
Okay. Okay. And how much would you say you guys had been spending every month?
Each of us about $125.
About $125 a month.
Yes.
Okay. And how do you divide that up?
There's one primary shopper every month. We take turns shopping, but anybody can shop, and then we just take that grocery bill and enter it into this magic spreadsheet, which calculates out at the end of the month which of us owe and which of us are owed by the others.
Okay. Oh, spreadsheets. It's getting down to that. Okay. But recently we understand some things have changed and the system is breaking down. So earlier in the week, our producer talked to one of your roommates, Paul, and here's what he had to say.
We're a pretty communicative household and we're pretty good about expressing ourselves. So it hasn't been too heated. I think it'd gotten to the point where Lizette and I essentially weren't cooking. Chen cooks all the time, but as our jobs, I think, have become more demanding of our time, it's been more difficult to do that. You know, sometimes I come home at 9 o'clock, so I can't really, you know, and Chen's probably not going to want to wait till 9 to eat with somebody. So it's not happening as much now, and I think it's mostly because of work, not because we are intending not to eat together.
Yeah. So life got in the way and the system is breaking down. And I understand that the spreadsheet is a bit problematic too.
Oh, because, yeah. So when we realized that Paul and Lizette were eating out much more and I was eating probably most of the food, I think that's what triggered Lizette to suggest not sharing food anymore.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the basic problem? What is the fight about? What you want to eat communally and they don't?
I think that was her idea behind the suggestion. And, you know, the way we communicated, it kind of de-escalated pretty much as soon as it came up. But it's still true that they eat out much more, which I don't contribute to. And
right.
They end up, I think about it as subsidizing my diet.
Yeah.
Jen, I have a question for you. Was the original intent of setting this up more based on having to do with, again, eating communally, or was it based on trying to save money? What was the original intention for doing this?
I think both the two of them and the original housemate who was here before me came from like more shared households where, you know, a big group of unrelated adults kind of share everything together. So there was that value of trying to share our resources. But yeah, it does save money too. Like it definitely saves not to have our own portions of things. And, you know, maybe something is going bad in the fridge and I don't touch it because I think it's somebody else's food.
So the thing, it seems like that you have stuck to the original, I don't know, I don't want to say contract, but to what you guys originally agreed upon. And they've been busy. And like I said, life happens. How are you feeling about this?
I think it's you know, as Paul said, it's not really dramatic because we're kind of forgiving and communicative people. But it is disappointing to find myself in a house where we're not sharing as much as I would like.
Yeah. Chen, are you losing money over this arrangement now?
I don't think so. I think the way that I, even though I eat more food, I'm also like contributing more to the energy efficiency by being more energy efficient and turning off lights and stuff compared to the other housemates. So it's kind of a give and take, but we don't try to be too exacting about it.
Okay. When it comes to money, is everybody still sharing the $125 a month? Let's say there's three of you. You each share, but then they're not eating out there as often. So they're spending their own money as well going out. And then it sounded like you felt even a little guilty about that.
Yeah, I definitely think about it because it's eating. So I'm doing it every day and I'm in the kitchen for, you know, hours a week. And that's something that I'm aware of.
So, Lewis, any thoughts on how the three of them can resolve this?
Well, I think they pretty much have to go back and take a look at the original intentions and what was, I think, was they said something that was ideal, an ideal philosophy about what would be the best way to go about it. But, you know, like you said, Sarah, things get in the way. There's life that gets in the way and it's practical. It's sitting down again and communicating instead of figuring out eating 100% of the time at home or 100% of the time outside now. It's how can you compromise instead of maybe picking just a couple times at home where everybody commits to coming home early and eating together and spending time together. So there's a form of compromise and then going back and reevaluating the budget of what would be fair to spend. Maybe it's not going to be $125 per person. Maybe it's $80 per person because they're going to be using the money to go out. And then, Chen, you can invite friends over to come and eat or you can go out to eat with other friends. So you can use the difference to do that.
Yeah. You know, Lewis, we noticed that a lot of the comments on financial feuds, they were about food and money, disputes about spending on groceries, spending about money going out. I know I'm always on my husband's case about, you know, going out to lunch rather than brown bagging it. You know, just brown bag it, save some money.
Well, there's a reason for that, because when you actually do a budget, when you're working with a financial planner and you're doing a budget, you're going to find out that you're going to spend a lot of money outside of your own home, your mortgage or your rent. You're going to spend it on food and especially eating out. And that's one of the best ways to save money is actually taking a look at your food costs.
Bottom line, what you're saying to Chen is they've got to rethink this, maybe have a house meeting and go back to square one.
Right. The good thing going is, I said, they're communicative. They talk to each other. And so they're going to go back and reevaluate that budget. But you know what? You don't need to complicate your life. It seems to me that they're also making things very complicated by doing this spreadsheet. And it's got to be a little bit simpler than that. And then they have to kind of also be flexible and compromise and roll with the punches. Not everybody's going to be able to eat at the same time. So, you know, if you cook, if somebody comes in and cooks, let's say that I'm your roommate, Chen, and I know that I'm going to be coming home late tomorrow night at 9 o'clock. I'll cook dinner tonight and get it prepared for tomorrow. And that way, if you want to come and eat at 6 o'clock, you just have to warm it up. And then I'll come in and warm up my food that I cooked the day before. So there's compromise.
Yeah. Chen, what do you think?
Sounds like you're suggesting going back to the like common values of the house, like how much do we want to share and looking at in practice what our limits are. That sounds reasonable.
Lewis, very good advice.
Yeah.
Personal finance expert Lewis Barajas. Lewis, thanks so much for coming in.
It was my pleasure.
And Chen, good luck to you and your roommates, and let us know how you resolve your problem.
Sure. Thank you.
If you want to weigh in on Chen's grocery bill fight, just go to marketplacemoney.org/financial feud. And while you're there, you can dish about your own financial feuds as well.
Who will come out on top? Fight!
If one of the roommates are eating out more, there's no reason for him or her to be sharing in the monthly cost.
If they're not, like, having guests or the food is not being consumed by an equal share of the roommates, then the communal cost should go away.
The idea of community meals, while it's an ideal, it doesn't always work out in real life.
You know, I've been in both situations, and people are quirky about their food habits. The best situation is to keep it all separate.
I think the whole system is flawed in this situation. I don't think he's right. I think divvying up things would be a pain in the butt, but I don't think that he's right. I think he should just not share food with his roommate.
K.O. No!
All the voices you're hearing responding to our financial feuds, they're people we met on the streets of New York City and Washington, D.C. That's Action Jackson, that's his name, folks, and Heather Fierce from our nation's capital, and Michelle Kamal, Arthur Haywood, Josephine Warshauer, Sarah Gancher, Shayna Warner, and Tony Pilano from The Big Apple. Let us know what you think, too. You can throw in your 2 cents on all the money battles you're hearing today and tell us about your own financial feud if you've got a good story. Just go to our website, marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner. It's time for round 3 of Financial Feuds. If you're just joining us, we're talking with listeners about their disputes over dollars and helping them resolve their fights about money. People came to us via our website, on Facebook, and through the Public Insight Network. And here's a surprise. Not. Most of the money spats involved married people. So how do you avoid stumbling into a financial minefield when you start a relationship? If you use dating websites, don't expect much financial pre-screening. As Marketplace's Sally Herships reports, fiscal compatibility is pretty much the last thing these corporate matchmakers are focusing on.
Diana Rafe lives in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. She used to run a crane and a forklift in a steel mill. Life was good. She was making big money. She fell in love with a local guy, got married. That's when the problems started. Her mom got sick, and Arafe had to head out of town to see her. When she got home, she found a boat in her yard. Turns out her husband had gone shopping.
What is this? Why did you buy this boat? We don't need a boat. Oh, and that's not all. On top of the boat, there were the car racing parts. $6,500 for a supercharger for his Mustang. And then there was the racing.
Not long after, they were divorced. Arafe did end up looking for love again, eventually. But this time, she wanted to be more cautious, to find a guy who shared her attitude towards money. So she went online. Digital daters will tell you one benefit of using a dating site is pre-screening. Arafe asked potential dates if they were spenders or savers, if they liked going out for big meals and worrying about the bill later.
Sometimes it's not enough to be just in love. Well, I was definitely in love with my ex-husband. But it didn't last. He ended up misusing money, and it hurt me very badly. It seemed like the ultimate disrespect.
eHarmony is perhaps the best-known site for questioning daters.
At eHarmony, we pre-screen each and every member for you to determine your matches based on compatibility.
eHarmony says its method of matching is the ideal barometer for predicting healthy pairs, so it doesn't need to ask specific questions about money habits. But PerfectMatch.com says you do need to ask. Dr. Pepper Schwartz created the matching algorithm for the site. She says money questions are so important. Perfect Match even offers a test called Money and Economic Aspirations.
Now with the economic downturn, I need to think and worry about money much more than I used to. That might be different. So I like to buy really, really nice things and have often spent more money than I really can afford. Those are two different kinds of people, you know?
I asked Schwartz how she knows which questions to ask.
I don't pretend to understand attraction, but I do know that there's a literature that talks about long-term compatibility. I can tell you, for example, that we have very good social science information that if people don't pool all their money, they will fight about money less.
Translation. Schwartz says her research shows if a married couple keeps separate accounts as well as a joint account, they tend not to argue about money as much. Schwartz says Perfect Match asks questions to figure out what you expect financially in a relationship. Like, I'd very much prefer to be with someone who earns more money than I do and is financially secure. True or false? But can an online test score a perfect union? Eli Finkel is a psychologist at Northwestern University, and he says the success of these dating sites has yet to be proven. But he says one thing we do know is that actually daters don't know what they want, especially about money. Confused? Here's an example. A single woman, we'll call her Jasmine, participated in a speed dating study Finkel did.
And she was at the very top of the scale in terms of her preferences for a man with good earning prospects, even in a speed dating partner.
In other words, Jasmine wanted a man with money. But then, the classic story. Girl meets boy, girl changes her mind. But since this is speed dating, Jasmine changes her mind really fast.
Well, what he wants to do is play the trombone on a cruise ship.
Not exactly a guy with big bucks. Finkel says that's the danger with online dating, screening, and money. People might think they know what they want, but put the same group in a room together, and predefined ideas like Jasmine's will fly right out the window.
There's reason to believe that asking people what they want is not the best way of getting at what they actually want.
So if you're single, Finkel says, don't try to pick your own online match. You might miss out on your trombone player. Or you can just remember the most important question you can ask about money in a relationship is whether someone is willing to answer more questions about money in that relationship. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
We're collecting stories about the kind of spousal friction that only money can bring. If you'd like to share a story about a financial dispute in your partnership, we'd like to hear it. You can tweet us at Radio Piggy Bank or reach us on Facebook, or you can dish by using a new web feature we're calling Financial Feud. It's on our website at marketplacemoney.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. What's the true cost of the things we buy? Find out by playing the interactive Worth It or Not game from Marketplace. Play the game and get exclusive coverage of the consumer economy at marketplace.org/consumed.
Okay, time for our final financial feud of the day. This one comes to us from Raleigh, North Carolina. That's where Kyle and her husband David live and where they have been arguing about the cost of daycare. Hi, Kyle. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Hello.
And let's also welcome personal finance expert Liz Weston. She's our financial feud judge and jury for this money battle. Thanks for coming in, Liz.
My pleasure.
So, Kyle, we're going to start with you. Tell us why the cost of daycare is becoming a problem for you.
When I first went back to work in March, my mother was watching our daughter, and we recently learned that my parents are being transferred to Seattle, Washington.
Okay.
So now we have to find daycare, and daycare is outrageously expensive in this area. I think if I had known that before we got pregnant, maybe I would have had a child.
How much is it?
We're looking at prices from anywhere $1,200 to $1,600 a month.
David, where do you weigh in here? Do you want to pay that much? Is that too much, or what's the dispute?
Well,
I think the issue between the two of us right now is trying to determine whether or not it would be worthwhile for whoever makes less money to stay at home. And
okay.
in that case, it's actually Kyle that makes less money. So we've been trying to decide what's the best course of action. And she's on the fence. You know, she wants to stay home, and I'd prefer her to stay at work because I'd even though the cost of daycare would take a good portion of her salary, I still think that the leftover money would be worthwhile for us to use towards other bills that we have.
And when you're talking leftover money, Kyle, what did you figure it was?
I mean, we're looking at daycare taking about 80% of my paycheck.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Liz, what do you need to know from these guys before you can help them out? What other information?
Well, are you guys planning on having another child?
Right now, no.
Okay.
No,
definitely not.
Is it just a financial decision, or is it just, you know, you're so overwhelmed at this point you can't even imagine it?
A little column A and column B.
Okay. All right. I get that.
How does health insurance come into all of this?
Well, she's on my health insurance. My employer gives much better health insurance than his does, which
uh-huh.
is another factor.
Liz, that could be important, right?
That's actually very important. And one of the things I wanted to talk about were all the possibilities and the permutations of this. But I want to ask David one more question. David, are you worried if she stops working that she won't go back to work?
It's not that I'm not worried that she won't go back to work. It's that I want to make sure that my wife has the opportunity to further her career.
Yeah.
And
I
feel somewhat selfish in, you know, trying to push her to stay at work, but at the same time I feel that if she stops working that it's going to be much harder for her to get back in the workforce. I've heard all the stories and everything, and it's difficult for me because I feel like the bad guy anyway I cut it.
Now, Kyle, how important is that to you at this point in your life, furthering your career versus staying at home with a child?
You know, I would love to stay home with my daughter for the first year or two, but if I do that, then it does impact my career, which I don't want, and it's very difficult.
Liz, at this point, what should they be looking at that or considering that maybe they're not?
Well, it's not just money, and that's something I think they already recognize. It's not just the paycheck that's coming in and how much is going out for child care. Healthcare is one of the big deals, and making sure that you have coverage and that it's good coverage. The fact is, when you take time out of the workplace, it gets harder and harder and harder to get back in, and you can't really recover a lot of times the lost pay, the lost pension benefits, if there's a pension involved, even the lost Social Security benefits, which is why I like couples to talk this over and think about every possible way that they might be able to work this out. If she can go part-time and hang on to the benefits, is that an option? If they stagger their schedules, is that an option?
Kyle, what are the possibilities for a compromise, like a part-time thing where you still get benefits, that kind of thing?
Well, that's something we've looked into. Like, I'm doing a compressed work week right now, and I've considered talking to my boss about maybe lessening my hours a little bit to take that further. But, yeah, we're trying.
David, what are you thinking at this point?
We've had the conversation where she said, you know, I don't want to pay somebody else to raise our child. And, you know, it's that you know, me too. You know, I know mm-hmm. that my wife would be the best person to raise our child, but I think that, I don't know. It's just tough.
Well, you still will be raising your child. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You're outsourcing part of this child care, but you still will spend the bulk of your time, you know, with your child. It's not like you're sending them off to Siberia somewhere. But I understand. You know, this is an incredibly emotional decision.
So, Liz, final word of advice. What have we decided here?
I do lean towards try to keep a foot in the workplace, even if you do decide to quit for a while. Keep up with your network. Make sure that you're still going to professional events now and then.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to the people you used to work with. I mean, don't just drop it because it is hard to drop back in. And you will have a tough time making up for lost time.
Yeah. Okay. Liz Weston, personal finance expert at AskLizWeston.com. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Kyle and David, they came to us through the Public Insight Network. Thanks a lot. And I'll be curious to hear what you guys decide. So let us know.
Great. Thank you.
I think she's right. She's just working to pay bills outside the house. She might as well not go to work at all.
Being able to have the relationship with your child rather than putting them in daycare trumps the financial loss.
Having job security is a lot more important. So what happens if he loses his job?
Of course she's not right. This is woman logic right here. They just want men to work all the time, pay all the bills. Yeah, that's good for you, but even if you're bringing in an extra $200 or $300 in a month, that's better than nothing.
It's time for every piggy bank's favorite game show, Financial Feud. And now your host, Sarah Gardner.
Thanks, Jeff. And welcome, everyone, to Financial Feud. Today, we have two contestants brought to us by the Public Insight Network, Christetta and Matthew. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
It's good. Christetta and Matthew are competing for an amazing prize today. Jeff, tell them what they can win if they're brilliant.
We have a beautiful bound signed copy of the book, Man vs. Markets by Marketplace Money senior producer Patty Hirsch.
And it's been called clever, insightful, and always entertaining. That's what the reviews said. So who wouldn't want to win that, right? So let's start. Matthew, Christetta, are you guys ready?
Sure thing.
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay. First question is to you, Christetta. Here it is. On average, how many times a month do most couples fight over money? How many times a month?
A month. I'm going to say at least eight.
Eight. Wow. Oh. The answer on that is two, actually.
Oh, way high.
Are you surprised by that?
Well, I guess I was I kind of overestimated thinking on all the different types of arguments that can be rooted in money.
Yeah.
At some level.
Yeah. Okay. And I thought maybe this was reflecting on maybe your own relationship. I don't know.
Yes and no, maybe.
Okay, Matthew, let's go to you. You have the next question. What percent of couples make every financial decision in their household together?
Oh, gosh. I'd have to say probably 10%.
10%. 10%.
Yeah.
Interesting. 31%.
Huh.
Are you surprised by that?
No, I was actually going a little bit low on this because I figured it would be a low number because I can't imagine that there's any couple where there isn't at least one financial secret out there somewhere.
That's right. That's right. Now, before we start our final round, let's get to know you a little bit. Christetta, where are you calling from?
I am calling from Faribault, Minnesota.
And what made you want to join the Public Insight Network and become a source for Marketplace Money?
Just a fan of the show, always appreciate the good quality reporting and thought it would be worthwhile to give back.
And Matthew, where are you calling from?
Albany, New York.
Albany, okay. And how have you found Public Insight Network so far?
Oh, it's been really fun, so just glad to be a part.
Okay, that's good to hear, and we appreciate you being part of it. So let's get back to the game. This is the final round, and in this one we have a multiple choice question, and you both get to answer it, but don't say your answer until I ask you, okay? So here it is. What is the definition of financial infidelity? Is it A, spending money on someone who is not your partner, B, spending money or incurring debt without the knowledge of your significant other? Or is the answer C, lying to others about important financial information like income? Matthew, we'll start with you. What do you think, A, B, or C?
I think it's definitely got to be B.
B, which was spending money or incurring debt without the knowledge of your significant other. Christetta, what do you think?
It can't be D, all of the above?
No, it's not an all of the above answer. What do you think?
Well, I also lean towards B.
Okay. You are both correct. You both missed in the first round, so you have a tie. You guys both win in this case.
Hey, not too bad.
Yeah.
And we have prizes for you, Jeff.
That's right. No one leaves Financial Feud without a piggy bank. This gorgeous replica of Marketplace Money's mascot, Piggy, can hold pennies, nickels, dimes, even old buttons, if you have no place else to put them.
And that's Financial Feud. Do you think you're a good judge of personal finance problems? You can play the game Financial Feud online at marketplacemoney.org/financialfeud. And thanks, guys. Thanks, Christetta. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, man. It was really fun.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week.
Ask a question or let us know what you think of the show at marketplacemoney.org, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page and keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, what happens when you try to wish your student loan debt away?
Look, the wishing star. Starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. I wish I might have the wish I make tonight.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Peroneta, and help this week from Margaret Airy. Jeff Peters is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.